Hello and welcome to our digestion lesson on the liver and the gallbladder. I'm excited to be here. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and the liver and the gallbladder with respect to digestion it's complicated. There's a lot to learn, but it's a really important piece for you to understand when you're working with your clients. So let's just jump right in and begin. And as usual, make sure that you understand that what I'm teaching is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. I'm not giving you medical advice. I'm giving you education. When you share with your clients, you make sure that they know that you're not diagnosing or treating, that you are providing education to help support them in balancing the imbalances in their body. Okay, so if you have somebody who's on any medication, or if you're on medication and you're listening and going, oh, I want to try that myself, just make sure that you bounce it by your doctor, because the things that we do with our clients and patients is so powerful that it can shift their need for medication. And if they are not aware of that, and they don't make their doctor aware of that, and suddenly they're having blackout spells because they're on too much blood sugar or blood pressure medication, or medication they no longer need, it can be a problem. So really, really make sure that you're always educating people about this. So let's just get started. The liver and the gallbladder. Let's just start by really getting in touch with our liver and our gallbladder. So I want you to take your right hand, and I want you to go to your side and right around to the bottom of your rib cage. I want you to put your hand so that the pinky side is at the bottom of your rib cage, and the rest of your hand is right above that. You're roughly in the place where your liver and your gallbladder sit. Okay, now the liver, as you can see from the picture, you see that ligament? We're going to learn what that ligament is later. Down the middle, which separates the two sides, that's right down the middle. That's very close to where the sternum is. So on the right side, you've got that right lobe of the liver. On the left side, you've got that smaller left lobe of the liver that extends over and actually overlaps a little bit onto the stomach. I'm telling you this so that you have an idea anatomically when somebody's telling you about a specific pain or ache, that you get what the anatomy is underlying it. And I want you to just be a nutritionist who talks about vitamins and minerals. I want you to understand where everything sits in the body so you can be able to help people to assess what's really going on. So there's the liver, the gallbladder. We're going to go through anatomically over and over again. But the gallbladder is this little green thing that you're seeing underlying it. This picture is set up so everything's transparent, so you can see the overlays and underlays of different pieces. So you've got your liver, this big old hunk up at the top. This thing down the middle, which you'll find out later, is the falciform ligament, which separates the left and the right sides. This green bundle that pokes a little bit out from under is the gallbladder, okay? These are the ducts. We're going to go into detail. This other little pouch is the stomach that overlays. You'll see at the top the vena cava, and then this is the esophagus at the top over the liver on the left-hand side, and that's the stomach. You actually even are seeing the kidney behind the stomach and the spleen, the pancreas, the spleen, and then the kidney down here. Okay, so you get to see it. And then the stomach dumps into the duodenum and down into the small intestine. We're going to go through this anatomically, but I want you to get a sense of it. So if you were to take your right hand and do what I just said, the lower, the part of the pinky is on the rib, the upper part is over the rib cage, and then you take your left hand and you touch your fingertips to your right hand fingertips. That little spot that goes from the midline and over to the left, you're seeing the top part of that left lobe of the liver overlaying the stomach. Okay, we're going to go through an anatomically on a microscopic level as well as a gross level, but it's important for you to understand all this, and I know, I promise you by the end you'll get it. So let's talk anatomically about the liver. It's a reddish-brown triangular organ. There's four lobes. What you see from the front are the two, the left and the right. We're going to take a look in a little while at the underside, and we'll see two other lobes. They're of unequal size and shape. The right is by far the largest. The liver itself weighs 1.44 to 1.66, very specific kilograms, depending on the size of the person, which is between 3.2 and 3.7 pounds. So it's hefty, but if you think about a 150-pound person or a 110-pound person, it's a very small percentage of their total body weight. But indeed, it's the largest internal organ, and the liver is also a gland, and it's also the largest gland in the body. And what you're seeing here is with little cutaways, you're seeing the inside, you're seeing some of the bile ducts, you're seeing the gallbladder, and this is the piece that's been cut away over here that underlies the words bile and gallbladder. So the bile produced in the liver, stored in the gallbladder. By the end of this presentation, you'll understand how all this happens, where all it happens, what are all the components of making this happen. Why do you need to know this? Because you need to understand what's going wrong if the liver gallbladder piece of the pie is not working properly for someone. So while you may think, well, I need to know anatomy and physiology, we need to know anatomy and physiology and biochemistry in order to know how to apply nutritional endocrinology and to become master of the digestive tract. So there's four lobes. This is a more realistic picture. We've got the right lobe, which is 5 to 6 times larger than the left. We've got the left lobe, which is that tapered part at the top, which is separated from the right by the falciform ligament. So if you look here, this big one, this is pulled out and you're looking at the underside. So it's flipped. The right side's on the left and the left side's on the right because we're looking underneath. If you look at the top, you don't see the other lobes. So on the right over here, on the right, you've got the right lobe, very large. On the left, you've got the smaller left lobe. Then you've got the caudate lobe. That's the one in the pale green. And then the one that's kind of in a, you know, purplish brown is called the quadrate lobe. Those are much smaller than either the right or the left lobe. So it's separated into these separate pieces. The other things you're seeing on this particular diagram are where the blood vessels come in, the inferior vena cava and the portal vein. We're going to go into lots of detail so you understand what their functions are. And then we have the tube here to the gallbladder. So that's what this picture is. And that's basically it. So let's look at the next picture, which is going to talk about the ligaments of the liver. And when we think about ligaments, we think about, you know, things that attach like a muscle to a bone, right? Or connect between, not muscle to a bone so much as connect bones to each other. So we have little ligaments that attach to the bones that keep them structurally together, but also allow them to move separately from each other. These are not ligaments in the true sense of the word. They're not separate structures. They're actually part of the peritoneum, which is the tissue that overlays the entire liver and attaches it to the diaphragm. So most of the ligaments attach the liver to the diaphragm. We've got the coronary ligament. There's two. There's the left side of it and the right side of it. In this picture, you're just seeing the right side of it. And that's the one that says coronary ligament. And it kind of covers, and it's like this whole, it just basically takes control of the top part of the liver and then attaches it to the diaphragm so that the liver's not floating around. It actually has some attachments. We've also got the left and the right triangular ligament, and you see the left one over here. We don't see the right one because it's kind of over to the side and covered, but the triangular ligaments connect the top part and the ends, so the far left and the far right, to the diaphragm. So the coronary connects the top part of the liver to the diaphragm, and the left and the right triangular connect the sides, basically the top sides. The falciform ligament is this big one that runs down the middle, and it runs from the diaphragm all the way to the inferior border of the liver, and then connects to what's called the ligamentum teres, also known as the round ligament, which connects the liver to the umbilicus, and that's a remnant of the old umbilical vein. Okay, so that's basically that. And why is that important to know? Well, sometimes there's some visceral imbalance. There's some physical structural imbalance where there might be a problem with the diaphragm and the diaphragm may not be moving properly. Remember, the diaphragm is a muscle, and people may have structural imbalances. So it's important to understand how it all fits together. Let's talk about the blood supply to the liver. So we have blood that's coming from the spleen, the stomach, the pancreas, the gallbladder, and the intestines that goes to the liver through the hepatic portal vein, which is down here at the bottom, not where it says portal vein. That's a larger one. The hepatic portal vein is right above that, has two branches. It actually has multiple branches going off into the other parts of the digestive tract. So blood supply from those areas go to the liver. Now, why would you think that the blood supply from the pancreas, stomach, and intestines would want to go to the liver? Well, the reason is that the liver filters the blood, right? The liver has all these enzymes set up to detoxify. And so the blood supply from those various areas are going to be having toxins in them that it's absorbed from the connection that those areas have with the food and other things. Okay, so it's really important that the blood goes before it goes back to the heart, because typically we have veins that carry blood back to the heart. We like it to go through the liver first to detoxify the blood before it goes back to the heart. And the liver has these detoxification mechanisms that happen through bile, and bile also is what helps to digest fats. When the blood leaves the liver, it collects into the hepatic veins that's up at the top and dumps into the vena cava, which is at the very top, and then goes up into the heart. So it's a very nice system for filtering the blood, and that's why everything goes through. Now, we're not going through a lot of the functions of the liver don't have anything to do with digestion directly, and that's not what we're going to study today. We'll study the detoxification capacity of the liver when we do our detoxification module in NEPT. We're strictly going to be looking at the anatomy and physiology and then relate specifically to the functions that are digestive in nature. So the next piece we're going to look at are bile ducts. So bile is produced by the liver, and that bile is part of that whole, let's take the toxins away and dump them into the stool so they can be excreted part, right? So the bile is produced by the liver, and it drains into these microscopic canals called bile canaliculi. On here, it doesn't look so microscopic, but you're seeing all these little channels. Those are the bile canaliculi. They are very, very tiny. And the bile canaliculi form together. Actually, you're not seeing. These are actually the bile ducts. So even smaller than that are branches off of here that are the bile canaliculi. And they form together to form bile ducts, which are these larger, it looks like branches, right? Those are all the bile ducts, and they carry the bile throughout the liver and into the gallbladder. Next, we have what's called the biliary tree. So the branch structure of those bile ducts is called the biliary tree. They get together, all those little branches come together to form what's called the left and the right hepatic ducts. And you'll see that here, the left and the right hepatic ducts. The hepatic ducts join together to form the common hepatic duct, which is the bigger one towards the lower edge. That common hepatic duct drains the bile away from the liver, takes some of the bile and puts it into the gallbladder to be stored and concentrated. And that's to control the flow of bile so that when you eat a meal that contains fat that needs to be digested, we don't have a constant flow of bile coming out of the liver and into the intestine. That could make you nauseous, right? A constant flow. What we have instead is the gallbladder to concentrate it. You know, it takes the water out, concentrates it, saves it up so that when this big fatty meal comes in, it can contract and squeeze and pump the bile out into this other duct, the common bile duct. So the bile goes from the liver, it's produced in those canaliculi, which go into the biliary tree, the bile ducts, into the left and the right hepatic duct, into the common hepatic duct. and then into the cystic duct, which goes into the gallbladder. Now, the cystic duct is a two-way street. It takes the bile from the liver into the gallbladder, and then when you eat a fatty meal or your client eats a fatty meal, the gallbladder contracts and sends the bile back out the cystic duct into the common bile duct. Okay, the common bile duct dumps into, as you can see, into the duodenum. Okay? And that's it. And then the fat digestion. And we'll look at the fat digestion. We'll look at how the fats are emulsified and micellized, etc. I'm putting a lot of pictures in here so you can get a graphical representation of this. So here we have everything labeled. We have the right lobe of the liver starting in the upper left hand as you're looking at it, but really it's the right if you're looking at it in anatomical position. So you've got the right lobe of the liver. You see the esophagus coming down and it kind of goes behind the liver and into the stomach. You've got the left lobe of the liver. You've got this green line down the middle of the liver, which is that falciform ligament, which attaches from the diaphragm down below. Then, of course, we have the stomach. You can see the common hepatic duct coming out of the liver and going towards the cystic duct. We have the pancreatic duct, which is when the body produces amylase and lipase and protease and all the other enzymes that the pancreas produces. It goes into the pancreatic duct, which feeds into the common bile duct, which feeds into the small intestine so that the breakdown of food can occur. We've got the common bile duct, which is here, comes down from the liver, comes out of the gallbladder from the cystic duct, and also the pancreatic duct dumps into that. So that goes into the duodenum. That's a piece of the small intestine. You see the pancreas, and you see the gallbladder, the cystic duct going into and out of the gallbladder, and the hepatic duct, the left and the right. So that gives you an overview. Don't expect yourself to memorize this and remember this and be able to look at a picture and name everything right away, and maybe never, but having an overview and being able to look at it. So when you have a patient who says, oh my God, whenever I eat, you know, a fatty meal, I just feel this doubling over pain. I feel it here. You're getting a sense of, oh, look at what's happening. Oh, the gallbladder is contracting. Maybe there's some stasis of the bile. We'll look at that later. It's a complicated process. And I want you to understand it because it's very common. Gallbladder surgery is one of the most common things. And for the most part, it's preventable. I want you to understand what's happening, where the gallbladder is. And there's a physical exam thing that you can do that we learned a little bit. I think we teach it in NEPT in the physical exam module, is you have a person lying on their back and you have them bend their knees. It takes some tension off the abdominal muscles. And you take your hand and you're going to be reaching under to where the gallbladder is, which is off as you're going up the rib cage. It's towards the midline, a little bit to the right of the midline. And you're going to take your hand and reach under where the gallbladder is coming out and then have the person take a deep breath. Well, what happens when the person takes a deep breath is that the diaphragm causes the gallbladder to be pushed down because the lungs are filling and the diaphragm's coming down, which causes the gallbladder to then move out and hit your fingers. And if somebody says, ouch, they're in a lot of pain when you do that, they may have an inflamed gallbladder. And wouldn't it be nice to be able to pick that up? Now, if you're not licensed to touch people, then you don't do this. Massage therapists can do this because they're licensed to touch people. MDs obviously can, nurse practitioners, chiropractors. But if you're a health coach, you can't, but you can teach a person to do it themselves. So there's a lot of things you can do from a physical exam standpoint, even if you're not licensed. And we teach that in the physical exam module. And when I do a group program, like my Energy Recharge Inner Circle, I teach people how to do physical exams on themselves or with the help of a family member. So there's a lot of things you can find out, like where the tenderness is. It gives you an idea if the pain that they're having after they eat is caused by the gallbladder, or is it actually something further down in the intestine? the more you know about the anatomy and physiology, the easier it is for you to identify where the blockages lie. So we're going to move to the next slide. So we've got the liver itself. And if you look inside, it's just, like I said, not a collection, a huge collection of cells. What it is that it's broken down into these little hexagons. So in that first circle, like we're going out, this little tiny spot, you bring it up, you're seeing a bunch of these little hexagonal type things. They look like circles here, but they're really hexagons, because if we break it up even further, we see this liver lobule, which is shaped in a hexagon. And then if we go even deeper, we see that at the apexes, the corners of this are what we call these hepatic triads, okay, or portal triads. And that consists of a branch of the portal vein, a branch of the hepatic artery, and a bile duct. So each of these little lobules has a central vein in the middle, which is bringing blood out. We have part of the portal vein and the hepatic artery and the bile duct at the corner. So we're bringing the blood in from where? From, well, the intestine, from the stomach, from the spleen, from the pancreas, coming in through these branches and into the lobule and supplying it with blood to be filtered. We also have oxygenated blood that's coming from the heart, which is the red, the hepatic artery branches, and that's just supplying the liver cells with blood so they can operate, right? So the liver is taking in blood in two ways. It's taking in blood as every other tissue does, which is oxygenated blood from the heart so that it can function properly, so it can do the nutrient exchange and delivery, toxin exchange, but then it also has these veins coming in from the portal vein, from the hepatic portal vein, so that it brings the blood that needs to be filtered. So it's really a complex structure, and we'll look at it in a little more detail. So this is the lobule, again, hexagonal shaped. At every apex is this triad. The triad consists of a branch of the portal vein, a branch of the hepatic artery, and a bile duct. So let's look at it in more detail. Approximately 100,000 of these small hexagonal functional units known as lobules. Each of them consists of the central vein, which is this thing right in the middle, and then six hepatic portal triads, one at each apex. And you can see this right here. A portal venule, we sometimes call it, because it's a vein. It's a branch of a vein. It's a smaller branch, a portal arteriole, an artery, and a bile duct. In between, you'll see these little tiny cells. These are actually the liver cells. So each of these little lobules consists of a whole bunch of cells. And in between the cells are these sinusoids. So they're like capillaries. They're tubes that go from the blood supply, from either the venule or the artery, right? Vein or the artery, and it carries blood from and to the center, actually to from these veins, because these come from the outside, and it goes into the portal vein. Okay, so if it's coming from the heart, it's oxygenated blood to supply the cells of the liver with the oxygen they need to do their function. But then it becomes deoxygenated and goes back into the portal vein, the central vein, which leads into the vena cava that goes back to the heart. If it's the venules to begin with, taking the blood from those organs, the spleen, the small intestine, the stomach, and it goes back in there. The central vein then connects it back to the vena cava, which takes it back to the heart. So it's a very complicated structure. You don't need to memorize this, but getting a sense of how it works, it just like illuminates and clarifies so much, okay? And then there's two main cell types. Amongst these cells, you're going to have what's called Kupffer cells, which are a type of macrophage. A macrophage is a type of white blood cell that are like little Pac-Mans that gobble up inflammation, okay? They gobble up bacteria. They gobble things up. It's your immune cells. Then you have the hepatocytes, which are cuboidal epithelial cells that line the sinusoids. and the majority of cells, of course, in the liver are these, and they perform most of the liver's functions. That's where the cytochrome P450 system is, of all those enzymes that help to detoxify. This is it up a little bit more close. So you see the liver up here. You've got this whole, like, just grid of these lobules, 100,000 of these. There's connective tissue in between them. And then this is what it looks like more up close and personal. You've got the portal triad, which is the portal venule, the portal arteriole, and the bile duct. Okay, we'll go through more in terms of the bile later. And then we've got, you know, look at the system. This is complicated. It's really complicated. But it works. But there's a lot of places where it can go wrong. And that's why we go through it. So let's shift gears a little bit to the anatomy of the gallbladder, and then we'll go into the function of both the liver and the gallbladder. Then we'll go into the nutrition and how to support people in having optimal liver and gallbladder function. We'll look at how it works in terms of fat digestion. So gallbladder is like accessory glands, stores the bile, concentrates the bile, and alkalizes the chyme. Okay. You can see where it sits. We've kind of lifted the surface up. It sits at the bottom of the right side of the liver, under the right lobe, very close to the midline. Okay, and it squirts its secretion, which is bile, into the cystic duct and then the common bile duct, so it can go into the small intestine and help us with fat absorption. We're going to do a few other pictures. On the left-hand side, it just shows you where it all sits and how it sits in relation to everything else. It's just a diagram, okay? And on the right-hand side is more of the, you know, a true anatomical look at it. Okay, it's green. Why is it green? Well, it's loaded with bile, and bile's green, right? So that's what it is. It's a small little thing, and it's very, very powerful and very important. Now, you can live without it, obviously, because people have it removed. We're going to talk about considerations for when persons had their gallbladder removed. What do you have to do to help them support themselves? Because, quite frankly, their doctor never told them anything. They may tell them to be careful of fatty foods, but that's the extent of it. They don't share with them how to avoid the situation that caused them to lose it. They don't talk to them about why they might have had to lose it. They don't talk to them about dietary changes. All they do is they just basically just take it out and say, have a happy life. We know better. And I want you to be able to support people who've had their gallbladder removed. I'm going to give you lots of strategies for that. So let's look at the gallbladder's job description. Well, it stores and concentrates the bile. It secretes the bile when it's needed. And that's the beauty of the gallbladder. If we don't have it or it's been removed, the liver is constantly producing bile, right? Because it's constantly doing its job. The hepatocytes are constantly working and dumping bile into those bile ducts, which end up coming out. And if the gallbladder's not there, it would go through the cystic duct and not have to go anywhere, so it'd go down into the common bile duct. So we'd have basically a constant drip of bile, which means two things. One, it's a constant drip of bile, so it can make people feel a little off or nauseous. Usually that settles after a little while. But it also means that if a person eats a lot of fat, there's no way to get a bigger burst of bile at the same time when it's needed. It's just this constant drip. So we'll talk about ways to address that in your clients. It also secretes bicarbonate into the small intestine to help alkalize the food bolus that's just come from the acidic secretions in the stomach. So this is, again, something that people aren't told when they have their gallbladder removed, is that possibly the pancreatic enzymes that need an alkaline environment are not going to be able to function as adequately because the gallbladder isn't there to neutralize it. And yes, the pancreas also secretes bicarbonate, but nature designed it so both the gallbladder and the pancreas produced it in order to create the pH of the bolus. So what we find is that people may not digest starch as well after they've had their gallbladder removed, because it's really important for starch digestion to have an alkaline environment. So if you've got somebody who's eating kind of a standard American diet and ends up having their gallbladder removed, they've been eating a lot of breads and cereals and pastas and cookies and crackers and cakes. So a lot of starch and then a lot of fat, usually hydrogenated fat, processed fats in all of those processed foods they've been eating. If they continue to do that, their body's not going to be very efficient at dealing with the fat, but also it's not going to get a high enough pH and more alkaline pH to digest the starch. So it's not just fat, it's starch you have to watch out for. Okay? Protein digestion doesn't seem to be as impaired when the gallbladder has been removed because the protein digestion begins in the stomach, and as long as the person's producing enough stomach acid, then they'll be able to get the protein digested. Chances are good, though, that if the digestive tract is malfunctioning and they're not doing the right things in terms of bile production and they've got some biliary stasis and they've got some things happening where the gallstones form, chances are pretty good that they probably have some low stomach acid or some other issues that are preventing that. So generally speaking, someone who's had gallbladder removed, you're always thinking, wow, their digestive tract is probably a mess and there's a lot we can do to optimize its function. Okay? Next, let's take a look at the functions. So we've talked about the anatomy. Now we're going to talk about how that anatomy allows for the major functions of the liver. We already talked about the function of the gallbladder, right? That's basically to be a storage place for the bile that's produced by the liver to concentrate it so it can store enough of it, and then it can secrete it so we can have a really good fat absorption. Now, we're going to look at how all that works and how the bile works and how the emulsification of fats works. But I want us to see what the main functions of the liver are. We're just going to be focusing on the digestive function today with a little bit of touch on the others. So one, the liver filters the blood. It cleans the metabolic wastes and toxins, neutralizes them to be excreted. It sends them into the bile to be excreted through the feces. And then some of the filtering creates some water soluble, which then gets filtered through the kidneys, gets into the bloodstream. It's a big thing that we're going to talk about today is fat digestion, producing the bile to emulsify the fats for easy absorption. And then it has a whole bunch of metabolic functions, regulation of nutrients, storage of nutrients. For example, we know that it stores vitamin B12. It stores the fat-soluble nutrients like vitamin A and D and K and E. It also stores some minerals. Okay, it also, like iron, the form of iron that's stored in the liver is ferritin. Okay, we've got copper, ceruloplasm. So there's a lot of functions it has on the metabolic side. We can look at those in more detail in another course. So let's look at the function of the liver. There you see the liver and the gallbladder in relation to the entire digestive tract. It produces bile, which helps to emulsify fat. If you don't know what that word means, hang tight. We're going to talk about that. It sends the bile to the gallbladder for storage. It also breaks down and recycles blood cells. If you've ever heard of bilirubin is one of those waste products. So if the red blood cells get broken down, either because there's a problem in the body and we've got hemolysis happening, breakdown of the blood cells, and that can lead to hemolytic anemia, that's a problem, or just the regular maintenance where the spleen is just saying, oh, these are old and broken down, let's get rid of them, and it puts them into a substance called bilirubin. Detoxifies the blood, removes alcohol, drugs, heavy metals, toxins, and Lord knows we've got tons of that in our environment today, right? It produces cholesterol. Okay? It produces cholesterol. It produces the lipoproteins, the LDLs, the HDLs, the VLDAs to carry fat to and from the cells. It produces urea, which is a nitrogenous waste from protein metabolism. So when we break down protein, protein has nitrogen in it, which carbohydrates and fats don't. And so the urea is produced from the nitrogen for excretion. It produces clotting proteins, right? People who with hemophilia have a problem with producing clotting proteins. Clotting proteins are super important when you get a cut or when you're trying to heal. It converts glucose into glycogen. Remember, it stores the glucose. We have a couple of different ways of storing glucose. You eat food, you eat too much, you don't need it all at the same time. Some of that glucose gets stored as fat. Some of it gets stored as glycogen. Basically, there's a certain amount of glycogen storage capacity in the liver. And once it's filled, then the rest of that glucose gets stored as fat. Or it gets stored as glycogen, some of it in the muscles, but then most of it gets stored as fat. It stores nutrients like the fat-soluble vitamins, vitamin B12, iron, and copper. And also metabolizes hormones. In those cytochrome systems where we're breaking down things, you're actually taking hormones, like, say, for example, estrogen. We have estradiol, estriol, estrone, and then downstream metabolites from those. Once the body's used those, we want to get rid of those. They're produced into 4-hydroxy, 16-hydroxy, 2-hydroxy metabolites of the estrogens for excretion. And if the liver's not functioning properly, we can get a buildup of some of the more dangerous estrogen metabolites. So it's really important that the liver be functioning properly. So let's look at bile, the role of bile. Bile is a bitter tasting, dark green to yellowish brown fluid. It emulsifies fat, meaning it breaks it into tiny globules. And we'll look at that more closely on the next slide. The bile is actually 97% water. That's a lot. 0.7% bile salts, 2%, 0.2% bilirubin, 0.51% fat, like cholesterol, fatty acids, and lecithin, and a little bit of inorganic acids. 95% of the bile is reabsorbed in the ileum. Like, what? But don't we want to get rid of it? Well, no. 95% is reabsorbed, but the stuff that's eliminated is where the toxic waste goes, hopefully. It eliminates cholesterol. So people with high cholesterol and they're eating a really good diet, I would be suspicious that their liver is not working properly and they're not eliminating their cholesterol in the bile. Maybe they have some biliary stasis. And it's mixed with sodium bicarbonate. So actually, the bile is at pH of 11, which is very alkaline compared to pH of 2 in the stomach. And it neutralizes the chyme, which is that digestive product, that food bolus that's gotten churned and mixed with enzymes, etc. So let's look a little bit more closely. The bile acid has what's called the hydrophobic side and the hydrophilic side. Hydrophobic means water hating. Hydrophilic means water loving. Lipids, fats, and water don't mix real well unless you've got an emulsifying agent. Bile acids are emulsifying agent. It helps the lipids and the water to play with each other. So if you have a lipid, which is a fat, that's the center part, and you've got a bile acid, the hydrophobic part, the part that's afraid of water, latches onto the lipid. And the hydrophilic side is on the outside. So basically, it takes the lipid and it breaks it down into tiny particles and makes it more water soluble. So it's easier for it to pass into the bloodstream and be carried around. So let's look at bile acids and bile salts. Bile acids are steroids. They're steroid acids. Okay, remember, cholesterol is a steroid, DHEA is a steroid, cortisol is a steroid. Those are all steroid hormones. These are steroid acids and they have steroid rings in them. When they're conjugated, attached to two amino acids, taurine or glycine, in the liver, they form what's called bile acids. The primary bile acids are those that are synthesized in the liver. The secondary bile acids are as a result of bacterial action in the colon. So let's look at the major bile salts. We have derivatives of cholic acid. So we have taurocholic acid and glycocholic acid. We have derivatives of deoxycholic acid. Those are taurocholic quino and glycoquino. And then we have this derivatives of 7-alpha dehydroxylated. And these are the deoxycholic acid and lithocholic acid. Why do I tell you this? Because you might see these if you're reading a study or if you're looking things up or if you do an organic acid test or if you do some sort of a test, a bile acid test. Okay? So, how do we get the fat digested? Well, fats don't dissolve in water. As you know, if you take some olive oil and you pour it into a jar of water, the globules just kind of sit on the top. We want them to be emulsified so that they can dissolve in water because the bloodstream is water, right? Blood is majority water. So in order to break down fat, we need lipase from the pancreas and bile in the liver and stored and concentrated in the gallbladder. Now the lipase acts best on emulsified fats. So the bile inserts itself between the fat and the water, like we saw in this picture over here. The bile is between the fat and the water so that it's basically suspended, and that process is called emulsification. Lipase then goes and efficiently breaks down emulsified fats. Doesn't do so well with the large fat globules. So if you're working with someone with impaired fat digestion, yeah, it could be helpful to give them some pancreatic lipase or a plant-based lipase to help them break it down. But if they don't have proper bile function, the lipase isn't going to work real well. So it's this synergy that we have between the liver gallbladder complex and the pancreas to be working as a team to break down the fat. And when you're working with people, you're going to hear from people, oh, I just don't handle fats real well. You told me to have some coconut and I don't handle it well. Or you told me to eat more nuts or seeds instead of eating so much of this processed food, but I don't handle fats real well. We're thinking, okay, where's the problem? Is it that they don't make enough bile or the bile isn't concentrated enough? Are they missing their gallbladder? And that's, of course, something you're going to always ask a person when you're working with them. What surgeries have you had? But the truth of the matter is sometimes people don't even remember. And you may even not notice it unless you're like a massage therapist. And you're looking going, oh, what's this scar over here? Oh, yeah, I had my gallbladder removed. Oh, you didn't tell me that. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. But the doctor told me it's no big deal. I don't need my gallbladder. You can live without your gallbladder, just like you can live without your appendix. Doesn't mean you don't need it. It just means you can live without it and the body will make up for it, but you're going to have impaired function as a result. There's nobody that has a missing gallbladder that can ever return to the full functioning of that fat system. So you're going to have to support them and they're going to have to support themselves in making the fats as easy to digest as possible. Super important that you understand this, and we have a whole slide on that. But here's the deal. The impact of poor performance by the liver and the gallbladder, what is it? Is it just that they double over in pain when they eat fat? Or they feel like they get gassy and bloated and their bowels don't work properly when they eat fat? Or is it a more systemic manifestation? So it really can manifest in any part of the body. It can manifest as fatigue. It can manifest as headaches, low motivation, depression, of course, digestive woes, yes, of course, bloating, gas, diarrhea, just feeling out of sync. It can manifest anywhere because when we don't properly absorb the fats, the body is missing the fats. We need the fats to make hormones. We need the fats to make neurotransmitters and to make the connections in the nervous system, the myelin sheaths. We need the fats to keep the skin hydrated. We need the fats for the immune system. We need the fats. Your client needs the fats. So if the gallbladder and liver aren't performing properly, they're not getting enough fat into their system, and you may find them exhausted. They don't even make the connection. Their doctor didn't make the connection, but you get to be the hero because you get to make the connection. So let's just look at what causes the liver and the gallbladder to malfunction. What is the biggest cause of liver disease? Overexposure to toxins. Like, it's exceeding the liver's capacity to handle it. The liver's great organ. It was designed to handle toxins. It wasn't designed to handle the level of toxicity in our current environment. It wasn't designed to handle constant exposure to alcohol or environmental pollutants. You know, occasional glass of wine, sure, a healthy liver can handle it. But an exposure every day, a few times a week, large quantities, alcohol binges, the liver can't handle it. And it sits weaker and weaker and weaker. And suddenly, the straw that broke the camel's back happens and it doesn't work properly anymore. And it leaves people confused because they've been doing it for a long time and suddenly it doesn't work. People say, well, I've been doing this my whole life. Why could you say, well, how could you possibly say that's causing my problems? The straw that broke the camel's back, right? It was working okay. There's a lot of resilience, and suddenly the resilience is gone. Poor diet's huge, right? Diet that doesn't support healthy function. Every single cell in the body requires nutrients. It requires the nutrients for the Krebs cycle. For those in NEPT, we have that whole module on how the Krebs cycle works. There's a lot of nutrients there. The depleted diets that most of the clients that you're going to see that come into your office, the uneducated, they don't know. Their diets are not supporting the healthy function. They're eating high fructose corn syrup, and that can lead to fatty liver syndrome. Non-alcoholic fatty liver can be caused by high fructose corn syrup. That sedentary junk food lifestyle causes the biliary stasis, the movement, lack of movement. Stasis is lack of movement. When we have biliary stasis, it's the lack of movement of the bile. It doesn't quite make it into the common bile duct and into the intestine where it's needed to break down fats. And you can have viral exposures, hepatitis A, B, and C, and parasites. All of these can affect the liver. And so if you're seeing that people are showing signs of poor liver function, these are some of the things you can look at. Gallbladder issues. Most people don't realize that food allergies can affect the gallbladder. Studies have shown that the most common offenders for gallbladder issues are eggs, wheat, coffee, pork, and onions. Kind of weird combination, but that's what the studies show. But you can also get gallbladder issues from inadequate stomach acid. The adequate stomach acid stimulates the movement. When people eat bitter foods, stimulates stomach acid, it also stimulates the lubrication of the digestive tract and the flow of bile. So bitter foods, we talked about that a lot when we talked about the stomach. They're also amazing for the fat digestion, for the bile flow, for stimulating. They're what's called cholagogues. And we'll take a look later at some other cholagogues. Lack of exercise. People are stagnant. They just don't get good oxygenation to their tissues. Weight gain. Sudden weight gain and also sudden weight loss can affect the liver and the gallbladder. Sometimes people have a sudden weight loss and it affects that, and people have gallbladder attacks after that. More childbirth. We have that saying, female fat, fertile in 40. Female fat, fertile in 40. You have someone who's had a bunch of kids. She's in the age of around 40. She's a little bit overweight. And of course, she's female if she's been pregnant. I don't know of many males that have been. Female fat, fertile in 40. High risk of gallbladder issues. The refined sugars, especially the high fructose corn syrup, affects the gallbladder. Birth control pills and synthetic hormones negatively affect the gallbladder. People are constipated. You've got a recycling of the toxins that are supposed to leave, and parasites. All of these things can create issues with the liver and the gallbladder. And it's a good idea to take a good history. You understand why you need to take a good history. So let's look here at gallbladder attacks and why people have surgery. If you look at the picture, you see the inside of the gallbladder and you see what looks like, they look like from here, little rocks, just little stones. They are. It's bile that has been formed together into clumps and calcified, oftentimes with calcium. There's cholesterol in those. There's bile and there's calcium, and they harden. And depending on the size, they can block the ducts. So if you look down, you see this huge stone that's large enough to block the common bile duct. People can die if their common bile duct is blocked off. You need to be careful what you understand when somebody explains to you some of the symptoms that you know. And even if you're going to work with them and help them to break down the stones and do all sorts of things, you've got to be working with a doc. I'll tell you a story about someone that I worked with years ago, like 5 or 6 years ago. And he had done a fast. He'd gone away to one of these really nice places. He'd done a 3-week fast, juice cleansing and fast. So he'd been off of all his processed food. And he did what a lot of people tend to do when they come out of that, is he decided to go to his favorite Mexican restaurant right after coming off this cleanse. And he ended up doubled over in pain and just like couldn't deal with it. And he called me and like, I don't know what to do. I asked him some questions. I said, stop eating, do not do anything, and just drink, and we need to get you an ultrasound. We need to see what's going on. Sent him off to the imaging center, and they said he had a huge stone blocking the common bile duct. He also had a gallbladder full of stones, and he also had a liver that had a lot of little stones and sludge, they called it, in it. And I said, he said, I'm not doing surgery. I don't know what to do. I said, well, we're going to get you a medical doctor who understands, found a functional medical doctor here, so that if he did need surgery, if, you know, he had somebody who was more functionally oriented could help him make a decision, because he was anti-surgery. And I said, I'll work with you, but it needs to be in conjunction with somebody else. So we worked together between the medical doctor and I. We got him to fast, which is the best thing to do when somebody has gallbladder. I don't care if they get headaches. I don't care if they're weak or dizzy. Fasting is the thing that's going to cause it not to contract. Because if any time you eat, you get a contraction of the gallbladder, you get a contraction of that duct, it's going to completely block it off. The pancreatic juice won't be able to escape. You have a backup of the pancreas. Food won't get digested. So you've got to get them to stop eating. Okay, this can be a serious thing. And I would not work with somebody who has that kind of a confirmed stone unless you're working in conjunction with a medical doctor who could get them in for emergency surgery if need be, because they could die. Really, really important. Okay, so that sluggish bile movement can lead to stones, usually made up of cholesterol. They block the passage of bile into the bowel, resulting in people being nauseous, they vomit, they have pain, doubling over pain, usually after ingestion of fatty foods. So what happened to my guy? He had just gone from Mexican food after being on a water fast and a juice fast, without food, without any fat for a while, and he gave his body a huge load. Did he go there and just have a little guacamole and some salad? No. He had the quesadillas. He had the whole shebang. Why he did it? Yeah, I was missing that food. Okay, so really warn people, if they are going to go do a cleanse, to be careful what they do after the cleanse, because you can go into a major gallbladder attack. Obviously, he had a problem before that, right? Because he had the buildup of these stones. When people get their gallbladder removed, it typically relieves some of those issues, but the gallstones can also affect adjacent organs. You can have stones that back up into the pancreas, and you can have stones that are actually forming in the liver as well. So removing the gallbladder doesn't remove the underlying cause of the problem, does it? Right? Why did they get the buildup in the first place? We've got to look to the diet and the lifestyle. We've got to help people to clean up. I have since worked with a number of people who were in that state, none as severe as him, but the fasting, the going on just water, sipping vegetable juice, you have to be careful. Even it has to be sipping, because anything that's going in there that creates an issue that causes a contraction can cause them to have severe pain and backup. Okay. You can check the lipase levels in the blood after the removal of the gallbladder. And if it's present, it means that there's inflammation present in the pancreatic tissues. That as a result of this gallbladder problem, backup of bile into the pancreas, then that you've got to look at, you know, really calming them down. So it could take a while for it to heal. That the basics is they've got to change the diet and the lifestyle and the underlying inflammatory process that caused this in the first place. So let's talk about once somebody has had their gallbladder removed, some special considerations, and then let's look at how do we prevent someone from getting into the situation where they need to get it removed. Well, how do we live without a gallbladder? You definitely got to get people off the fried foods and the trans fats. And yeah, some medical doctors are telling people that, but they're not necessarily telling them in a way that people are hearing. It's like, yeah, you'll do better if you don't go out and eat French fries and fried food. But they don't give them the full scoop. You're uniquely qualified to give them the full scoop because it's not just fried foods and trans fats. It's other things like dairy products, fats cooked with sugar, which can create a problem, and grains, because they're not going to get efficient digestion of starch without the gallbladder bicarbonate. What can they do? Well, using bitters before the meal to stimulate the bile production and movement. So, you know how I said there's a constant drip when the gallbladder's not there from the liver? If they have bitters before the meals, it actually helps to stimulate a little bit more of that production. Supplement with lipase to help support that. So the lipase is actually helping what fats are getting emulsified. And then supplementing with bile salts. Two with all the fatty meals. And 5 days on, 2 days off until they're feeling really well. But cycling them on and off. Bile salts are something that we produce and we need. And we still produce after the gallbladder is missing, but we don't concentrate them. So we want to have a little bit of that extra with the meal. Now, some people who are vegan will not want to take bile salts because there's no bile salts other than those from an animal. But you've got to kind of talk to people. I'm vegan. I've been vegan. I don't like to do things that hurt animals. But you've got to also take care of your body. Right? And if I don't have a gallbladder, I want to provide that. If I don't have a certain organ and it makes certain hormones or certain things, I need to provide it from outside. So we need to get to have those conversations. You will have folks who will not take it no matter what. And in that case, you're just going to have to work with them with the bitters and with some herbs and cholagogues that you can take with the meals. And I'll show you what those are. Okay? Lots of things you can do. But what we really want to do is keep those folks from getting their gallbladder removed in the first place. So as part of your education with people, especially people who are coming from a standard American diet, who've had a lot of fructose in their diet, who've had a lot of processed fats, they're likely to have some issues going on here, even if it's not manifesting. So you have them do periodic fasting and juicing, if you can, to just calm everything down and flush out any congested bile and prevent the formation of gallstones. And you have them do bitters with their meals, which are natural cholagogues and help the flow of bile and bile salts. And then have them take herbs and foods that thin the bile so it doesn't sludge up. It's the thickened bile, the stasis of the bile, the non-moving bile. So things like beets and especially if you ferment them like you have, you know, like I forget what it's called. Like we used to have pickled beets, but there's a name for them as well. If you can ferment beets, just like you can ferment cabbage and make sauerkraut. Turmeric, awesome. Milk thistle, artichoke, dandelion. Those are nice things that thin the bile. You can have people take apple cider vinegar or a separate supplement of malic acid. Malic acid is high in the apples, and apple cider vinegar is a great place to get it. It softens the bile, so the stones don't tend to form. And anti-inflammatory herbs to keep the inflammation down. Antispasmodic herbs to keep the ducts from going into spasm and closing in around the stones. And then there's various liver and gallbladder formulas. But if you suspect that there's stones, ultrasound is super important. Now, if it's not within your scope to order an ultrasound, you send them back to their MD or their naturopath to get the ultrasound ordered. There are liver and gallbladder cleanses that people can do. They read about them. They do. I'd caution them to work with a practitioner to do those cleanses, someone who knows what they're doing, to be guided, because there's red flags and there's times when they can get into trouble and they can start to move those stones out of the liver and have them get stuck and go into a gallbladder attack. So there's a lot of things you can do. There's preparatory, where you're doing malic acid containing things to soften everything and break things down. it's really important to work with somebody who knows what they're doing. So going back to my guy who had the problem with the huge stone, and I thought for sure the guy was going to have surgery. We started working with him with some of these bile thinning agents. We worked with him with some digestive enzymes. We worked with getting his inflammation down. We had him do, I think it was a 10-day water/juice cleanse. And after a while, he was feeling better and better and better. And I was like, you have to go get this rechecked. Yeah, I will. We have to go look to see. Because I had a conversation at that time. I was in herbal medicine training with David Winston. And I said, David, what should I do with this? He goes, he's going to have his gallbladder out. And I said, but he doesn't want to have his gallbladder out. Well, you know what? He's probably going to need surgery. And he said, my experience is that when you start to do this herbally, what happens is, yeah, it might clear up temporarily, but the stones tend to go back into the gallbladder. So I said, okay, I'll keep that in mind. But he didn't want the surgery. I don't like to have people have surgery. So we went back and redid his ultrasound. And the big stone, gone. All the little stones in the gallbladder, there were very few. All the sludge that was in the liver was gone. So what he had done was actually reverse it. Unlike what David thought, that it was going to be absorbed back, he actually had gotten rid of these stones. And as far as I know, he's never had a problem again. He and his wife moved out of town. The wife went on to naturopathic school and then went on to medical school. So he's in good hands now. But this is what kind of a problem he had. Okay, so there's a lot of things that can go wrong with the liver and the gallbladder. We talked about what can go wrong with the gallbladder, where it accumulates stones, and the problem is the stones get trapped into the ducts. But there's things that can happen with the liver. We can have fatty liver, and it can occur as a result of inability to process sugar or excess triglycerides. Both of these happen when people are on a high sugar diet. Immunity and autoimmunity, the body can be attacking itself. Belly fat can cause problems with fatty liver. Increased metabolic problems, alcohol, high fat, and high sugar diets. So if you look at a healthy liver, the top picture, nice pink, looks pretty on the inside. Then you look at the second one, even the color changes. It gets more brownish instead of that nice pretty reddish. But the cells look unhealthy and you see all those fat deposits intermixed with the hepatocytes. Not a good thing. Fatty liver, steatosis, you'll see. Cirrhosis. Cirrhosis is a thickening, hardening, enlarging of the liver. Most common cause is alcohol, but there are non-alcoholic causes. And then hepatitis, which is an infectious process where you're mostly, an infectious hepatitis is what we think about, but hepatitis really just means inflamed liver. Itis, right? Hepata. But most of the time we think of it as type A, B, C, or a combination of that combined. And it's usually an infectious process. But all of these things can be supported. And milk thistle is one of the best herbs for cirrhosis because it helps. It's an antioxidant for the liver. And we see things go down and change and the liver enzymes improve. We'll look at the enzymes in a little bit when we look at evaluation. So it's all reversible. It's just a matter of really talking to people and guiding them to make the changes in their diet lifestyle for this to happen. This is a long list, small print. This is basically lists of symptoms that can occur. So this is from a history point of view, what may be happening in liver gallbladder so that you know. This is part of our liver gallbladder assessment when you do the digestive assessment. Those are all provided to you. So early on, they may have no symptoms. We don't even know what's going on other than what? Risk factors in the diet. Greasy or high-fat foods cause distress. They tell you that. They get lower bowel gas or bloating several hours after eating. That could be related. They get a bitter metallic taste in the mouth, especially in the morning. Belching throughout the day, chronic fatigue, irritability, tendency to headaches, anxiety. Some of those are generalized symptoms. It could be anything. When you're asking questions and you're putting together a history, it's the picture, the whole picture that explains it. So itchy skin. The liver is associated with the skin. And yellowish, jaundiced skin, yellowish cast to the eyes. The stool color can change from clay colored to normal. Clay colored stool means the fat's not getting absorbed very well. Sometimes they get really red skin, especially on their palms, or dry, flaky skin or hair. And that's related to the fats not being absorbed and being able to nourish the system. If they have a prior history of gallbladder attacks or stones or hepatitis, shoulder pain on the right side, sometimes they don't feel it in the liver itself, but it refers pain to the right side. They've had their gallbladder removed, or they have a family member or history of it. If they're female, fat, fertile, and 40, they teach that in medical school. They have environmental sensitivities. Sometimes pain in the back between the shoulder blades, again, a referred pain. They tell you that their stools look kind of greasy and there's kind of an oil coat on the top of the water after they have a bowel movement. They get easily intoxicated and hungover, which suggests that the liver's kind of sluggish. They use a lot of alcohol or they're alcoholic, which means that their liver is being broken down. But sometimes they don't have any symptoms. And what you're going to see it is on a routine blood analysis. And you go, whoa, the liver enzymes are elevated. What the heck is going on? So when you're doing some testing, there are some reflex tests that you can do. This is in applied kinesiology. They teach this, that tenderness between the sixth and seventh rib on the right, over the third rib, 3 inches to the right of midline, and tenderness right below the rib cage, which is where that lies. What I told you before, where you can put your hand in and go at an angle from the left to the right, right, like just to the right of midline and at the edge of the rib, have them breathe in. Tenderness there would suggest there's some gallbladder. If you do a blood test, you might see increased SGOT or SGPT. Those are the old names for them. They're now called AST and ALT. Increased LDH, increased GGTP, increased alkaline phosphatase, decreases in uric acid could be that their phase two liver is not working efficiently. You can also do a liver detox panel through some of the functional medicine labs like Genova Diagnostics. And you're going to see elevated cholesterol or ratio of cholesterol, HDL and LDL are wrong due to the decreased bile efficiency. So a lot of those are signs. So here's in detail, the liver profile consists of these five elements. ALT, also used to be called SGPT, alanine aminotransferase, found primarily in the liver, but it's also found in the heart. So when you're looking at labs, what you're doing is putting together a symptom picture. So if they have a lot of other symptoms of liver, probably the ALT being elevated is related. There are also things called isoenzymes, which we can look at in a moment. AST or SGOT, an enzyme that's aspartate aminotransferase. It's found in skeletal muscle and the heart as well. It's also found in the livers. So high levels can represent liver disease, but also you have to make sure it's liver and not the muscle. Bilirubin, and that's the breakdown product of the hemolysis, the breakdown product of hemoglobin. If it's high, it can result in jaundice. There's a condition called Gilbert's syndrome. Gilbert's, they sometimes call it, Gilbert or Gilbert, and that's where there's a slight elevation of bilirubin. And that's like it's between maybe it's 0.8 and 1.2, whereas you'd normally want to see it below 0.5. That's Gilbert's. It usually doesn't have any issues, but you might find that somebody with Gilbert's has a tendency towards higher cholesterol levels and lower HDLs. Alkaline phosphatase is a body protein important in diagnosing bone and liver. Okay, so if you see a bunch of these, then you're thinking it's probably liver. If you see one of these, like you just see alkaline phosphatase and everything else is fine, you might be thinking more bone, and there's something called isoenzymes that you can do. Alkaline phosphatase can also be elevated in someone who has leaky gut. And finally on here, the liver profile part one, lactate dehydrogenase, LDH, is found mostly in the heart muscles, liver, kidney, brain, and red blood cells. So again, you're looking at whenever there's damage to an organ, LDH is released in greater quantities. So if it's just LDH, you don't know. You want to do isoenzymes to see what the problem is. But if you have a plethora of these results, then it's pretty clear that it's pointing to the liver. Not to say that the other areas might be problematic. Now, here's the thing, though. Conventional labs have very large ranges for these. And so you want to be really astute in looking at these. You want to be able to look and see not just where the exact levels are, but compare it to the person's last test and the last test and the last test. These are usually done as a standard part of a blood chemistry screen, so likely they have old tests. And if you see that these are normal, but they're inching their way up, that says to me, let's look to see what stresses are going on in the liver so we could nip it in the bud before it becomes pathological. The conventional medical approach is to just do it after it becomes pathological. Not good, right? You don't want to wait till it's a pathology. You want to catch people in a preventative state. A few other things that could suggest that there's issues with the liver. You look at the protein globulin albumin, albumin globulin ratio, and the GGT, which we mentioned before, which is glutamyl transferase. This is very common in alcoholics. If somebody says, yeah, I just have a little bit of wine, no, I don't have an alcohol problem, and they have elevated GGT, very likely that they're an alcoholic or they're overusing alcohol. So the proteins that measure the state of nutrition in the body, there's albumin and globulin, which are types of proteins, and then you look at the ratio. And these could suggest, if these are out of balance, that there's some issues with the liver. So this is just looking in specific things. If you see GGTP high and you see alkaline phosphatase high, chances are good that it's the liver. But if you also see that cholesterol is low, LDL is low, and HDL is low, then it could be bile insufficiency. Okay, just little ways that you can look. And then these are just ways to look at these numbers and what common patterns you'll see. We won't go through each of these, but this is something for you to print out and keep handy if you do lab tests and you're looking at them. Somebody you see that has a combination of these things or a lot of these things, then you're thinking liver, gallbladder. So if they have a high glucose, a low BUN, low protein, low albumin, high globulin, high bilirubin, high alkaline phosphatase, LDH, AST, ALT, if the ALT is low, it could be early fatty liver. GGT, iron, cholesterol. High iron can be hemochromatosis, but it can be related to the liver because we have too much iron in the system because the liver is not able to store it properly. So all of these things can play in. And the more you do it, the more you understand it. We have something called isoenzymes. So remember we said LDH, alkaline phosphatase, it can be related to other things besides the liver. So when we do the isoenzymes of LDH, if I see LDH elevated pretty high, I'm like, you need to get isoenzymes. Let's see where this is going on. Is it the heart? Is it the red blood cells? Is it the white blood cells? Is it the lungs? Is it the kidney, placenta, pancreas? Obviously, placenta only applies in a pregnant woman. Liver and skeletal muscle. So you want to look at these isoenzymes to determine where the problem lies. Alkaline phosphatase can be liver, bone, intestine, placenta. So we look at that as well. Whew. So we've looked at anatomy. We've looked at physiology. We've looked at function. We've looked at the pathologies that can happen. We've looked at the various things that can go wrong with the liver and the gallbladder and how to look for it, how to detect it. We've even looked at how to look at lab work to an extent, and I encourage you to go deeper with that. Now let's look at what can we do to support them. What can we do for prevention? What kind of herbs and foods can we use to help people move things through so their liver and gallbladder don't get sludgy? So we have general diet and lifestyle support for the liver. Avoid late night snacking. You know, you eat late at night, then you have all this bile flow, and then there's stasis because people go to bed. Get to bed by midnight at the latest because the liver regenerates in Chinese medicine cycle between 1 and 3. And a lot of people who stay up late don't ever get in that optimal time of liver regeneration. And of course, we know decrease the toxic load, like pure water, organic food, lots of fiber to bind the toxins. Everybody needs to do an oil change. It's one of the first things I do with my clients. We get them off the fried foods. We get them off the oxidized heated oils. We get them on some good omega-3s. And then making sure that they have ample high-quality protein. And there's a lot of individual variances, depending on whether a person's athletic, a marathon runner, a weightlifter. but we don't need as much as we think. Okay, you can always supplement with protein powders if needed, or spirulina and other green powders. Most of the problems I see with protein have more to do with low stomach acid than it does to do with getting enough. But when people are going on cleanses and doing things that bring their calories down, when they're on weight loss regimes, they may not be getting adequate protein. If they're getting calorie-sufficient diets that are not just junk, they're generally getting enough, but are they digesting it? So sometimes we want to give them pre-digested proteins in the form of protein powders. So some liver and gallbladder support. There's the lifestyle stuff, which we go over and over and over again throughout this digestion program. Breathe and relax before eating. Chew thoroughly. There's the foods to avoid, like sugar, refined carbs, high fructose corn syrup, gluten, allergens, alcohol, trans fats, bad fats, heated fats. Now, certain fats can be heated without too much damage, like olive or coconut. Most people are not frying their foods in that. They're buying foods that are the chips that have canola oil and safflower oil and sunflower oil, and they're organic, and people think it's healthy. It's not. It's putting a strain on their liver and gallbladder. You want them to have those good fats, the chia, flax, hemp, walnuts, deep ocean fish, algae, chlorophyll-rich foods, lots of water. We want to have them avoid overeating and skipping meals. And I don't mean like skipping and having only two meals a day. I mean, when people go too long without eating, they tend to overeat. And that's why the skipping meals can be important. There are some supplements they can do, like bitters. They can take lipase, a digestive enzyme. They can take taurine. Remember taurine, taurocholic acid, part of the bile. Vitamin C is important. There's all kinds of liver cleansing herbs. I've listed a few, and we have another slide that goes through them in more detail. Milk thistle, dandelion, yellow dock, burdock, hawthorn. Liver stimulating herbs, fennel, anise, cayenne. And this is not meant to be exclusive and complete. You might have others that are your favorites. Lecithin helps to emulsify. Peppermint oil, B vitamins. All of these are important components, and you need to determine which of these are going to be the best choice for your person by looking at what are their habits, what are they already doing, what have they done in the past that's worked. So here's a bunch of liver-supportive foods. The brassicas are amazing because of the indole-3 carbinol, because of the sulforaphane. They stimulate phase 2 liver detoxification. They help support it. They help provide nourishment to it. And all of these, they provide various ways that they support. Citrus peel, caraway, turmeric, avocado, basil, beets, bitter greens, mushrooms, cardamom, cayenne, chlorella, cilantro, cinnamon, dandelion, dill, fennel, garlic, ginger, grapefruit, green juices, Jerusalem artichoke, onion, peppermint, rosemary, sea vegetables, thyme, radishes, wheatgrass. All of these can be supportive. You may have some of your own favorites, but you also have to work with people's dietary preferences and food allergies and other things going on in their body. So I can give you a list, but you need to help tailor it to the individual client. Some of the superfoods that support the liver, spirulina, chlorella, green matcha tea, chlorophyll, seaweed, milk thistle, burdock, dandelion, hawthorn. I like to buy the whole milk thistle seeds, which you see there, and I have them grind them themselves and make gomashio, liver lover gomashio, mix that with broccoli seeds, broccoli sprout powder, things like that, and make an awesome liver support, help to support it. Now, some of these are supporting the detox mechanisms of liver. If you support the liver's ability to detoxify, you're going to support the liver's ability to digest fat, to make bile, to not get sluggish and not get sludgy. Here are what's called cholagogues. Cholagogues help to stimulate the flow of bile from the liver and stimulate the bile secretion from the gallbladder. So if somebody's got sluggish gallbladder function, cholagogue herbs are going to help it to stimulate that so the bile doesn't get too concentrated and start to form stones. They strengthen the liver and they enhance detoxification. So you can't go wrong. These are some of them. Some of them are very, very potent and you have to be very careful with them. And some of them are not. I don't see gentians on there, but I don't see celandine. That's the one that's can be pretty powerful. So be careful if you don't know these herbs. Use the ones you know. Learn about them before you use them. Artichoke, barberry, blue flag, boneset, dandelion, fringe tree, gentian, golden seal, greater celandine, rosemary, sage, wild indigo, wild yam, and yellow dock. I love yellow dock when people have problems with hair loss, and when people have problems with skin. I find that yellow dock works well. It's also a good source of iron and helps stimulate the digestive flow, the hydrochloric acid. So learn about these. If you're working with somebody, it's a learning opportunity every time you get a new client. If you're thinking, well, maybe fringe tree, I don't know much about that. Maybe that would be helpful. If you're suspecting somebody has some sluggish function, you want to help them prevent having a gallbladder attack. Or they've had a gallbladder attack before and you want to prevent yet another one. You can do a gentle, what I call a gentle 5-day liver gallbladder cleanse. Some of them are really, really potent, and you want to work with a practitioner to do that. But these are some that are a little bit easier. There's herbs. I like Health Force because they're all food-based, but there's a lot of other companies that have liver herbs. I use one capsule 3 times a day of this Liver Rescue or any of your favorite formulas just to get a gentle thing going. The gut rejuvenator, green drinks, simple to digest foods, bitters with each meal, and as many liver support herbs as you can. The dandelion, the burdock root, all those sorts of things. Have a daily drink 3 times a day. This is gentle. This is not the drink a quarter of olive oil and expel all these stones. This is gentle. It's just a tablespoon of lemon juice, a tablespoon of organic olive oil, and a tablespoon of apple cider vinegar. If a person can't tolerate the vinegar, have them put malic acid in there. And that's just going to help to soften everything. And you just can do this for 5 days. You can go on, take the liver formula twice a day for a month. And then alternate it. I know some people who switch their patients between one liver formula, then the next, and they rotate and they always have them on some sort of gentle liver support, but not the same one all the time. Probiotics are great, and the daily diet list. Okay? What else can we do? This is just to give you a little quick look at the detoxification, the way this works. You've got the portal vein that brings the blood from the intestines. You see that at the bottom. You see the artery, the hepatic artery that brings fresh blood from the heart. All of these go in. Remember, we talked about once it goes into the liver, it goes down into the globules, and those globules have one of each of those, the bile duct, the portal vein, and the artery, those little branches of those. There's 6 of those per lobule. That's where your detoxification is happening. And then the bile drains out and into the intestines to get rid of the waste. So the blood in into the lobules, all the bile is picking up, and you've got the hepatocytes that are doing the cytochrome P450 system, the enzymes to break things down, phase one, phase two. We'll go into way more detail in our NEPT detoxification. I go through each of the phases, each of the stages, sulfation, methylation, complex product. But if the liver detoxification isn't working well, the liver gets sluggish, and that's going to affect digestion, which is why I bring it up. When do you do bile salt supplementation? I definitely do it after gallbladder removal. Remember, I said I usually go on and off, maybe 5 days on and 2 days off. I go really slowly because it can cause a dumping syndrome. It can cause them to get diarrhea. You just want to go really slowly, find their dose. And when the gallbladder's sluggish, or they've had a history of past gallbladder problems, or a family history, or they're female fat fertile in 40, then I might supplement. But I'm not real keen on bile salt supplements for everyone. I like to just really stimulate and make the thing work better. So let's look at general support through diet. Avoid the late night snacking because the liver regenerates between 11 and 3. This is a kind of a summary. Clean up, water, organic fiber. Do the oil chains, no fried, no oxidized foods. Do the EFAs. And with protein, it's the Goldilocks principle. Ample, high quality, individual variances, and you can use things like hemp and chia, which have good fats, but also supply good protein and are easy enough to digest. You also want whole foods, nutrient-dense diet. We talk about this for just about everything in the body, right? Lots of greens, but for the liver support, mustard and dandelion, especially those really bitter ones. Fruits and veggies, and don't get rid of the citrus peels. Have them grate the citrus peels, or have them freeze lemons or limes and then blend up the entire thing, or then do the grating and the zesting that way. Fats, okay? Good fats. Omega-3s, but not the processed fats. Choline, you can do soy lecithin, sunflower lecithin. Some people are allergic to soy, but usually the lecithin is fine. Good quality mushrooms, radishes, beets, artichokes, cruciferous vegetables, vitamin C-rich foods, vitamin E-rich foods, B vitamins, turmeric, curry. All of these things can be supporting the liver. Teach people how to use these foods and incorporate them. Superfoods, the super greens, spirulina, chlorella, green matcha tea, chlorophyll, seaweeds, milk thistle. All of these are important. And extra reading and video clips. Play these, watch these. I love the first one, The Liver Anatomy. The guy, he actually draws the pictures. And all the stuff that we talked about today, he explains. And he takes you through it. It's a great summary. I'd go and watch this right away. Liver Physiology, it's the same guy showing you the physiology, but it's around about, I think it was around minute 8 that he gets into the bile duct and the digestive part. He also is showing a lot about the other things that the liver does in terms of the detoxification and all that other stuff. It's great to watch, but if you want to watch specifically the digestion, you go there. The Liver Structure and Flow, that was a different person, but it was interesting. It's a little drier. The other guy was really funny, but it gives you some good stuff. There's one on liver cirrhosis. I think we spelled cirrhosis wrong there. And then on pathology, this is a good one on pathology. That's a PDF. That's not a video, the last one, but it's really good because it summarizes all the different liver pathologies. So that's it for the liver gallbladder. This has been a very long video, probably the longest one in the entire digestive tract. Couldn't figure out where to stop it and how to make it into separate videos. So there you have it. Plan on watching it over and over again and getting it, because it's really important that you understand how the liver and gallbladder work if you want to really optimize someone's digestion. So thank you, and I look forward to being together on the next video.